From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The city of Los Angeles will now allow homeless residents of Skid Row to keep an unlimited amount of personal items on the street. The city made the deal with advocates for the homeless. Business owners and some downtown residents aren't happy about the personal stuff that'll be on the street. We'll debate the new policy right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you're having a terrific start to your day. Coming up a little bit later, we'll debate a parcel tax. It's on homeowners within the L.A. school district's boundaries. The measure will be on next Tuesday's ballot. EE is its lettering. Superintendent Austin Buettner and UTLA union leader Alex Caputo-Pearl will make the case for passage. Our guests from the Chamber of Commerce and the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association will advocate voting no. We'll get into the specifics of how the money would be spent and how much a typical homeowner would pay. That's later this hour. But first, the city of Los Angeles has settled with advocates for homeless residents of Skid Row. And many local businesses and residents aren't happy about the terms. The deal follows years-long litigation and judges' decisions limiting the city's ability to remove personal belongings of people on the streets. We'll talk about the deal that was announced yesterday with the LA Times reporter Gail Holland, who covers homelessness and poverty. Gail, good morning. Thank you for being with us. What are the details of the deal?
Hi, Larry. I wanted to correct one thing in your lead-in. I don't think too many people would agree that it's unlimited possessions they're allowed to have. There's a lot of limits on the possessions they're allowed to have, including the city can cart away sofas, refrigerators, and pallets, and some of these large objects that have been the focus of much of the consternation about the growing camps, both in Skid Row and Los Angeles. And in the rest of Los Angeles. What they said is that the city can't set a ceiling on how much they can accumulate in the streets. So, for example, the example that the plaintiffs gave anyway was Nathaniel Ayers, the homeless man kind of made famous by our columnist Steve Lopez, the homeless musician, Juilliard trained, who his cello would have been carted away under the city's policies on limiting possessions. So that's basically the agreement in a nutshell.
So there's no limit on quantity, but certain large items, refrigerators, couches and the like can be removed, and items can be removed for health and safety purposes. But I wonder, and you know, many...
Oh, sorry, given no. that on Skid Row, there's, you know, the area where the tents are pretty much businesses, mainly industrial warehouse businesses, and you can't block an entrance or exit or driveway. So that also will be a limit on how much possessions people can have on Skid Row. And just one last point. So this sets up a different standard for Skid Row than the rest of the city, where the city is maintaining a limit, a volume limit on how much stuff homeless people can keep in the streets.
I guess I'm wondering, as a practical matter, if there's a limitless quantity of personal items that an individual can have on the street, what sort of challenge is that for city workers to determine health and safety violations? Because you could have vermin that's attracted by things but buried under a pile of stuff, and someone working for the city wouldn't even be able to see that.
Well, I don't think that's a problem that the sanitation department highlighted. When I watch the cleanups, they go in first with a hazmat team. And generally, they find contamination because many people relieve themselves or have bugs and or there's rats down there. And they pretty much are able to dispose of things pretty easily. If anything's contaminated within a tent or an area, they will dispose of it. I think this is going to cause them to be a lot more careful. I think perhaps more of a limitation than difficulty determining what's a health hazard is simply city resources. Last year, they spent $31 million on cleanups, and I don't think anybody, I haven't talked to anybody who's too happy with the results. The feeling is that the camps are still proliferating everywhere, including on Skid Row.
We're talking with LA Times reporter Gail Holland. She's written the piece about yesterday's announcement by the city of Los Angeles that it's reached an agreement with advocates for homeless residents of Skid Row, that there's no limit on the quantity of personal property that an individual can keep on the street. There are limits on large-sized items like refrigerators and couches. Also, any property that poses a health or safety threat can legally be removed. But I'd like to hear from you. If you're a downtown business owner, a customer who shops downtown in the Skid Row area, if you're a resident within the boundaries or adjacent to the boundaries of Skid Row, what do you think about this agreement? Again, as Gail said, different than other parts of Los Angeles where city officials can remove what's considered to be excess property. In this case, in the Skid Row area, they will not have that latitude to do so. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jose Huizar, the city council representative who covers the Skid Row area, voted against this mediated agreement, Gail. So what were the concerns he expressed?
Well, one of the concerns that you just highlighted is that this distinguishes Skid Row from the rest of Los Angeles. And I think he feels that this is going to continue to maintain Skid Row as a dumping ground for homeless people and their belongings, as many people feel. He is making efforts and has made efforts to and has called on the rest of the city and the county to regionalize homeless services. And I think many people feel that the reason Skid Row is as it is, as big as it is, as long-lasting as it is that the city in the past made a decision to what was called contain homeless people in that area. And their idea would be that first it wouldn't impinge on the rest of downtown as it gentrified or revitalized over the past few decades. But the idea was also it would make it easier for them to obtain services. But the feeling now is that that has not been a success, that very few people exit successfully from Skid Row. So that's pretty much his belief, and I think many of the residents of downtown who also see the trash and the camps from Skid Row spilling over into other parts of downtown.
Evan in Beechwood Canyon in the Hollywood Hills wants to know, is an agreement like this being considered for other parts of the city, or is just specific about the legal challenge affecting homeless residents of Skid Row?
To my knowledge, unless it's behind closed doors, it's not being considered for the rest of the city. But the settlement agreement has a clause where the parties retain the right to challenge either under the Constitution, which is what this challenge was filed under, or any other law further enforcement efforts. So I wouldn't say it's been ruled out as far as litigation. The city has not mentioned recently anyway rescinding its limit. It was only imposed in 2016. Its implementation was delayed. But again, I think the city now, what they're really running up against is a resource question. How many millions of dollars, how many sanitation teams with police escorts and guards to fund versus housing and services?
And at this point, even with L.A. City's bond money to be used for providing housing, the gap between any new properties that can be developed for homeless people and what the need. I mean, you're talking presumably tens of thousands of units short.
Correct. And in addition, the state has given several major infusions. I believe at the end of last year it was $500 million or $600 million. Not all for L.A., but L.A. gets the bulk of it because we have the most homeless people. But that money can't be spent on cleanups.
All right. Let me share a comment. Pippi writes on the page, so put simply, these are homeless people who are hoarders without houses. Joaquin in South L.A. said there are two distinct types of homeless camps. One type where residents treats it like his or her home, one where trash is dumped anywhere and everywhere. Pragmatically, these two types of people should be treated differently, but that's probably not good optics or legally feasible. Gail, did the negotiations, to your knowledge, try and get to the issue of hoarding at all, or is this just sort of strictly constitutional? The advocates argue that doesn't matter if it's hoarding or not, that's in the eye of the beholder, that people have the right to have their stuff and not have it taken.
I haven't heard any credible expert say that they think hoarding is a problem. I think that the plaintiffs would say that two shopping carts full, which is what would have been, which is kind of common and would have been, would be outlawed under the 60-gallon limit, which is what the city has imposed in the rest of the city. If you actually look at what is in there, it's actually things that people use and need. I think that there could be another issue that wasn't really addressed by the settlement, is the city has been talking for years about expanding storage for homeless people. And the storage that exists on Skid Row is used very heavily by the people of Skid Row. But thus far, they have only expanded that a little bit. They opened a mobile storage facility near Olvero Street when they opened a new shelter there. And there may be, and there's other storage areas associated with new shelters or new facilities. But in general, for people living in the street, there still remains a tremendous shortage of storage space.
Let's talk with Nikki in Echo Park. Nikki, thank you. Your thoughts about this agreement?
Hi. Yes. I'm very much in favor of legislation like this. I wish we had more opportunities to provide greater rights for homeless people. My husband and I go down to Skid Row quite often, at least once a week. And while there is a little bit of chaos down there, I still think it's inappropriate until LA County can come up with legislation that provides some sort of adequate housing for homeless folks. It should not allow the city to come around and do roundups and take people's things. They need their property, they need their food, their clothes, their blankets, and they have a right and they're entitled to have those things. So I'm very glad to hear that there is some progress being made.
Nikki, appreciate your call. Thanks very much. Steve in Long Beach says, I'm a commercial truck driver. I was just in Skid Row. The homeless situation, the crowding has made it really difficult for me to be able to make deliveries. Eric in downtown Los Angeles writes on the page, maintaining the status quo where people are allowed to live in filth and disease is absolutely insane. There's nothing humane about letting people live in squalor. People who do not want to live in housing due to rules will simply exist on the street where they can live without having restrictions and partaking in substance abuse, education programs, job programs, etc. In essence, what the settlement does is allow people to exist if they choose on the street, a condition that harms everyone, including the homeless and the housed. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Gail Holland, Los Angeles Times reporter, we appreciate your being with us.
Thank you, Larry.
Thanks. We'll see what the next steps are. Again, this settlement passed the L.A. City Council. One of those who voted in opposition, the councilman who represents Skid Row downtown, Jose Huizar. Coming up on Air Talk, we're going to debate Measure EE. It's on the ballot for those that live within the boundaries of the L.A. Unified School District. It is a parcel tax of 6 cents per square foot of constructed property on a lot, and that money would go to the general fund of the L.A. Unified School District. We'll talk about how that additional money might be spent and the pros and cons of the parcel tax when we continue in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our second hour, the theme park wars with Disneyland, its new Star Wars attraction opening tomorrow. We're going to talk with Hugo Martin of the LA Times, who's actually ridden one of the big attractions and is going to tell us what it looks like. Star Wars Galaxy's Edge is the biggest expansion at Disneyland since it opened in the mid-1950s. And we'll also talk about what other parks locally are planning to do in response to the new Star Wars attraction. That's next hour, right here on 89.3 KPCC. But we begin with Measure EE on your ballot next Tuesday if you live within the boundaries of the LA Unified School District. Joining us to talk about how much the tax is and where the money would go, KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Good morning, Kyle. Good
morning, Larry.
So how much is the tax and how will it be determined on a specific property?
Yeah, so this is a parcel tax. So it's kind of like a property tax, but it's charged a square of fee per square foot on properties of 16 cents per square foot. The idea is that at least the initial estimate said that it would raise something like $500 million all told every year for the LA Unified School District and that would fund their operations. We can get into the argument here about what exactly it would fund, I think that we should note here that what kind of square footage gets taxed. Well, what the district says initially that they intended to tax was your home, quote unquote, habitable square footage was the ballot language that the school board voted on. But that has come under some legal scrutiny recently because the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association sued, saying that the superintendent made changes after the school board voted on that language, sent language that would tax a much broader base of structures, apply that 16 cent a square foot to things like your pool and your garage. Now, you know, you talk to the county assessor and he says the likelihood of those pieces of property actually getting taxed is quite low because they don't have the data on those properties. But there's still the question of whether or not Superintendent Buettner had the authority to make that change in the first place. So 16 cents a square foot would raise something like $500 million as initially estimated. Questions about what it would apply to that 16 cents a square foot and this sort of hanging legal question about whether or not that change was within the authority of school board staff to do.
Well, it's also interesting if you've got a homeowner with a massive property that the parcel tax is only going to be on the house as opposed to the entirety of the grounds.
And two other things I should mention too here, Larry, and that is one that if you are low income, I don't have the threshold right in front of me, but there's a certain income level at which you're exempt from paying the parcel tax. And there's also an exemption for seniors that they can apply for in this tax. But yes, I mean, this is sort of the kind of it's kind of a clunky mechanism for taxing here. As with all property taxes, there's a certain element of like, well, how much, you know, how do you assess the value of the property? How do you apply those property taxes? It has, and it's even more clunky because it's a pure, in some cases, parcel taxes can be leveled as flat fees per property, you know, $200 per property, no matter what it is. This is different. This is a per square foot fee. But it maintains some of that kind of, you know, clunkiness and you might even argue inequities that are baked in with that.
And it's an uphill battle, clearly, because it requires two-thirds passage,
right? It does. That's right.
So it's a very high threshold, and all registered voters within the boundaries of the LA Unified School District vote on this, whether property owner or not.
Right. That's right. And and presumably, I mean, the argument would go if you're a renter, even if you don't have a property tax bill, the possibility that this parcel tax, you know, if it were to be enacted, could be passed on to you as well. So, you know, there are other people who have a stake in this, even if you're not a property owner.
KPCC, K-12 education reporter Kyle Stokes joining us on Air Talk. Also with us, superintendent of the Los Angeles Unified School District, Austin Buettner. Thank you, sir, for being with us. Describe where these additional funds would go if the parcel tax is passed.
The funds would go right to schools, Larry. We're going to use them to reduce class size, to make sure we have more counselors, nurses, librarians in our schools to support the classroom teacher.
All right. And when you say classroom size reduction, do you know how many teachers you would be looking at hiring to accommodate the smaller class size?
It's a ramp. So we start with a few hundred, we get to a few thousand over a period of years. And the goal is to reduce class size. So I could take you to class tomorrow with 38 kids in a math class. We know we can do better than that. We have to do better than that. A smaller class allows that teacher to develop more of a relationship with each child, spend more time individually with the child. And 38 is just too big. I could take you to a school. We have one counselor for 750 students. That becomes triage. Doesn't allow the counselor to do her best work. Doesn't allow access that the students need to a counselor. I was at an elementary school yesterday, doesn't have a librarian or a library aide every day. So think of the journey to become a reader in elementary school. We need to make sure our libraries are open every day, our children have a chance to read and become readers every day. So we need more resources in our schools. And this referendum is really pretty simple, which is New York funds schools $23,000 per student, $23,000, Los Angeles, $16,000. $16,000 is not $23,000. It's not enough. This will cost the average resident about 75 cents a day, and we think for 75 cents a day, there's no better investment to make than children.
We're talking with Austin Buettner, the superintendent of the L.A. Unified School District. Also with us, the president of the Teachers Union, United Teachers Los Angeles, Alex Caputo-Pearl. Sir, good to have you with us again. How much of this will go to the increase in salaries for teachers that was negotiated after the last strike?
This isn't about paying for that salary increase. This is about what Mr. Buettner just went over, which is class size reduction, counselors, nurses, librarians. Really the animating features of the strike in January that brought tens of thousands of people out on the street and united Los Angeles. I mean, look, I've been a teacher for 22 years in South LA, and I've seen all of these things, and I've been in education for 28 years. And we have not had an opportunity as Los Angeles in my 28-year career like we have right now to bring $500 million in to very specifically target class sizes that are at 46, counselors who have 500 students that they're trying to get to, schools that don't have nurses. What the strike created was a pathway. It created a pathway for class size reduction, fully staffed schools, et cetera. If we pass Measure EE, we can double down on that pathway. If we don't pass Measure EE, then it's going to be a temporary pathway. Nobody wants that for Los Angeles. And I just want to say to what Kyle brought up earlier, look, this is structured in a very progressive way, where senior homeowners are exempt, disabled homeowners are exempt, 80% of LA renters live under rent control. It cannot be passed on by landlords legally under rent control. Over 70% of the $500 million is generated by those who can afford it, big business and corporations and corporate landlords. This is a progressive tax that will go to the needs of kids who are 90% kids of color and almost 90% low income. This is an equitable, fair, justice-oriented thing to do.
We're talking with Alex Caputo-Pearl, the president of United Teachers Los Angeles, superintendent of LA Unified, Austin Buettner, with us as well. The two speaking in favor of passage of Measure EE on next Tuesday's Los Angeles School District area ballot, a 16-cent per square foot of developed property tax. The parcel tax would be collected and used for the general fund of the LA Unified School District. Superintendent Buettner, with California's Prop 98, which guarantees 40% or so of the state's revenue going to public education, and we're looking at a boom year in revenue collections, why would that additional revenue that's earmarked for schools, why is there a need for additional tax funds beyond that?
So go back to those two numbers I shared, Larry. 23,000 in New York, 16,000 in Los Angeles. So the bulk of our funding does come from the state, about 90 cents of each dollar. So 90 cents of the 16,000. About 10 cents comes from the federal government. If we look at what we have to do, the state of California, of course, we need to increase funding. It should increase. But we also need to take this step as local communities to support local schools, just like Oakland, San Jose, San Francisco, Burbank, Torrance all have. They all have local revenue measures so they can provide more than 16,000 each of their schools. So we'll continue to work at the state level. We hope that will increase. Meanwhile, and in companion with, we have an opportunity to bring local dollars, put them right in our local schools. We don't need to send it to Sacramento. We don't need to send it to Washington. Let's keep local money in local schools. But by any measure, we don't have adequacy, and 16,000 is just not enough.
Mitch in West Los Angeles asks if classroom aides are going to be part of the additional personnel. He says classroom management has become a huge part of the job in classrooms. So in addition to class size reduction, will there be additional aides? Alex Caputo-Pearl?
Yes. So this is for personnel like classroom aides. It's also for personnel like custodians. We've got our public schools that don't have enough building and grounds folks. For large campuses, et cetera. So it's for all of that. I would just add quickly that California is 44th out of 50 among the states in per pupil funding, which is something we raised during the strike over and over again. And we're going to keep hammering the state for more resources so that we're not 44th out of 50. We were just up last week. Teachers and parents from around the state were in Sacramento hammering away on state funding. That said, to get out of 44th place, it's going to have to come from multiple sources. So cities like San Jose, Oakland, San Francisco, Torrance, Burbank, Santa Monica have already passed measures like this. LA's got to get with the program. It's going to have to come from multiple sources for us to be, for the richest state in the country, to actually be up towards the top in per pupil funding for our kids.
Austin Buettner, LA Unified Superintendent, like other coastal California school districts, there's been a decline in the number of students as it's so expensive for families to live in the area. There are fewer kids enrolled in public schools. Charters have also taken a significant percentage of students who had been in district schools. Given that you're looking at a smaller school population, couldn't there be savings achieved by closing campuses, cutting back on the size of administration, many ways that you could cut the overhead of education in the LA district to provide the additional funds for more aides, support to services, and smaller class sizes?
So first and foremost, we want to make sure we have strong local schools serving local communities, and we can make our system more efficient than we are. We've reduced costs by more than $100 million just in the last 9 months through a combination of shrinking the central bureaucracy and finding ways to save on healthcare. Now, we don't brag about it because shrinking the central bureaucracy is also reducing people, good people, but we've had to get leaner and we will continue to do so. And we've saved more than $50 million in healthcare costs working together. There was no cage match between labor and the district. We sat down and said, here's an interesting idea, a more cost-effective way to provide the benefit that's been earned for out-of-state retirees. We're saving $50 million. We're looking at procuring pharmaceutical and medication differently, which will save another $10 or $20 million. So we're working to reduce those. It will take time, Larry. But meanwhile, we still have the big issue of adequacy. So we're going to make ourselves leaner, more efficient, reduce the bureaucracy, but we've got to get from 16,000 to 17 to 18. And there's just no way we can get to the place we need to be for students if it costs 23,000 in New York to think we could do it somehow in Los Angeles for 16. The math doesn't work. So we don't have adequacy. We have class sizes which are too big. We have teachers being asked to do two or three different things when we want them focused with the student. We have schools which are not as clean as they should be. So we need more.
Will any of the money raised from Measure EE be distributed to charter schools, or does the district keep all of the funds generated for district schools?
This is for all kids, all schools, Larry. So about 20% of students in public schools today are in charter schools, about 80% in a traditional governance model. The 20% or so, 20% of the funds will go to charter schools and the students in those schools, and the other 80% will go to traditional public schools. So all kids, all schools.
And are there formulas for how that 20% would be distributed to charters, or is that at the discretion of the district?
It's very prescribed. It's by the attendance, the actual attendance in each of the schools.
All right. I want to thank you both for being with us and sharing the case for Measure EE on next Tuesday's ballot within the boundaries of the LA Unified School District, asking voters whether a parcel tax of 16 cents per square foot of constructed property should be assessed against property owners. That money would go to the general fund of the LA Unified School District. With us, Austin Buettner, LA Unified Superintendent, and Alex Caputo-Pearl, President of UTLA, the Teachers Union. Coming up, we'll hear two opponents of Measure EE. Our Kyle Stokes, KPCC Education Reporter, is also with us. We'll be back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Coming up next hour on Air Talk, Disneyland with its brand new Star Wars attraction opening tomorrow. We'll talk about the biggest expansion in the history of the park. That comes up a little bit later right here on Air Talk. But right now, we're debating Measure EE on next Tuesday's ballot. Within the boundaries of the LA Unified School District, voters will decide whether to tax property owners at 16 cents per square foot of developed property. We just heard from school board, president of UTLA, the union, Alex Caputo-Pearl, and superintendent of the district, Austin Buettner. Also with me, the chair of the LA Area Chamber of Commerce, Jerry Newman. Jerry, thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. First, just give you an open opportunity to respond, take one of the points we just heard from the previous gentleman with which you disagree.
Well, first of all, I think the discussion about where the money would go has to be primary in terms of how we are addressing this issue. In the whole discussion, they failed to mention that there's a structural deficit of about $600 million, which the district is facing in just 2 years. When Mr. Buettner came to the chamber to discuss the opportunity of a parcel tax, the first thing he said was, we have this deficit that we're facing and we need to raise money, otherwise we're going to be taken over by the state. So it amazes me that the math that they're doing on a per pupil spending doesn't apply to the math that you need to see on how do you raise $500 million that gets spent for new things like new teachers in classrooms, new nurses, librarians, counselors, all of those things that are additive, and not discuss what's happening in your deficit that you have to fill. So if you're going to use the $500 million to pay for all the new stuff, where's the money coming from to fill the deficit?
So you're saying the money is actually going to go to fill that hole?
It has to, or some other money is going to, so they're being disingenuous. Either it's going to be this money, or they're going to look for a new tax later on to fill the deficit. But in the meantime, they've got to make a case to the state and to the county in just a short amount of time as to how they're going to be solvent in 2 years. And what they've said is where they're going to make that case is with this tax measure.
And is the deficit you're talking about, is that largely driven by retiree pensions and health care or by other factors?
It's, as I understand it, as was described to us by Mr. Buettner, it is predominantly health care and retirement pension funds that have not yet been funded. But it's also a myriad of other structural issues that they have with their administrative costs.
All right. Also with us from the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, Vice President of Communications, Susan Shelley. Susan, good to have you with us again.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
From the property owner perspective, what do you see as the effect of this if it's implemented?
Well, this is a huge tax increase. This is a tax of $160 per 1,000 square feet of your home, or your business, or your apartment, $160 per 1,000 square feet. And the money goes into the district's general fund. So they can say all day long they're going to spend it on this or they're going to spend it on that. It's going into the general fund and nothing is guaranteed. It is not guaranteed to go to the classroom, to go to counselors. Where are their priorities? Why are they talking about more employees for buildings and grounds when they need counselors? Where are their priorities? What kind of management is this? People should go to reformlausd.com. That's the Howard Jarvis site, and find out more about this and find your polling place and go to the polls and vote no on this tax increase on Tuesday.
What if part of this is just the first phase of additional taxes that the district is going to seek? So maybe this goes in part to deal with the structural deficit that was just talked about, also to do some of the hiring that advocates have talked about, and then come back with other mechanisms down the road. If the district, their position is that it's way underfunded compared to comparable districts, why not taxpayers pick that up?
Well, what they're doing is they're attacking Proposition 13. That's what this is about. This is a property tax. It goes around Proposition 13 because it's not based on value. They're basing it on square footage, so that's a loophole. It's a property tax. If you raise property taxes too much or too often, people lose their homes. This is not a good thing. This is why Proposition 13 was passed in the first place in 1978, because property taxes were rising too fast and people were forced to sell their homes. And we don't want that to happen. California has the highest income tax, the highest state sales tax, working on the highest gas tax, working on the highest corporate tax. Only the property tax is held in check, and they are coming after it, and it has to be stopped.
We have Mark in Woodland Hills who said the proponents' argument are straw man arguments. To say another district is spending more per capita isn't useful information. To equate the $23,000 per pupil that New York has with our district doesn't help. Is the money being used more efficiently? Where is the extra money going? I want to know how the money is being used. That's Mark in Woodland Hills. Jerry, let's go back to the per pupil funding, because we hear these numbers a lot, that LA Unified and most California districts, the claim goes, are way underfunded compared to districts in the rest of the U.S., particularly comparable urban districts.
Well, we do hear that, of course. The reality is what they're saying is they're taking actual dollars spent and then adjusting for cost of living on that comparative basis. What they're not saying is that we actually, on a per pupil spending, are about middle of the road with the rest of the nation. When Austin says we're 44th in the nation, that's adjusted for cost of living. Our actual pupil spending puts us pretty much in the middle of the road, and I think the gentleman who wrote in is absolutely right. What we're not seeing is how efficiencies are working. We have not been very efficient with the money that's being spent. We have a district that has about two-thirds of its employees in administrative positions, one-third in the classroom is the numbers we've gotten from them. They have, in the last number of years, you've had the number of students decreasing by about 30%, yet administrative costs have gone up over that same period of time by 20%. So we're not addressing these efficiency issues that the person who wrote in has mentioned.
All right. Why wouldn't you, though, adjust for the cost of living? Because a dollar in Los Angeles isn't going to go as far as a dollar in the heartland of America. So if you don't adjust for cost of living, you don't really get a sense of the educational bang per buck, do you?
Well, I think if you adjust for – it is true that you need to recognize that Los Angeles is an expensive place to live. But we also have – the district covers more than just the urban area of or just the center of the city of Los Angeles. It covers Southgate and other areas. So if you're going to adjust for cost of living, you need to take into account those costs within those areas as well. When you think about adjusting it merely for the city of Los Angeles, which has a much more expensive means of living, and in Southgate – probably not as much as would compare to middle America better. So I think that you, when you're talking real dollars, you have to look at it both ways. You have to see it as where are we comparatively real dollars, and where are we relative to how the district in its vast sense spends money efficiently.
Well, I think the district and the teachers union would argue that teachers live all over, but they live in what generally is a high rent or high property value area, and that teacher salaries need to be respectful of the fact of what it costs to live in the Southern California area. They shouldn't be paid the same as teachers who are paid in low cost of living areas.
Look, I mean, we have I think the highest paid teacher in LAUSD we've reported recently is over $470,000. So
that's an anomaly.
That's an anomaly, yes. But I mean, you have high paid teachers and you have low paid teachers. Look, from the chamber's point of view, we advocate consistently for paying our teachers well, for having funding for schools. We have supported over $20 billion of taxation revenue bond measures over the last number of years, which we're still paying for. And in each instance, we have never said no to the school district relative to any kind of revenue measure.
We're going to take a break. We'll continue our conversation. Susan Shelley of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, Jerry Newman of the LA Area Chamber of Commerce. They're both in opposition to Measure EE. It's on next Tuesday's ballot. Those within the boundaries of the LA Unified School District will have a chance to vote on this. 16 cents per square foot of developed property. The property owner would pay that annually. It'd be a little over $300 a year for the typical homeowner. We'll continue our conversation in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're debating Measure EE, which would raise money for the general fund of the LA Unified School District to be voted on by registered voters within the boundaries of the district on the ballot next Tuesday. With us in studio, Jerry Newman of the LA Area Chamber of Commerce, Susan Shelley of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, and KPCC reporter of Covers Education, Kyle Stokes. Kyle, I wanted to ask you about the per pupil funding, because I know, you know, this is an ongoing controversy as to how does LA Unified and California generally stack up with the rest of the country.
Yeah, I'm just looking at a story here from EdSource, which is a you know, nonpartisan news organization that covers education statewide. And I think that the moral of the story is that however you could rank California as the middle of the pack on some measures or as way behind the pack on others. I think the general average of all those numbers is that California is behind the curve generally in terms of how much money is spent on per pupil education and how much it spends on education compared to other states. So the question of where all of that money is going is the very crux of this question of how you measure per pupil spending. Those numbers vary so widely. The rankings of between 26th in the nation and 44th in the nation go to what do you not only just cost of living, which we talked a lot about, but what do you count as a classroom expense? Do you count, paying for a principal as a cost of educating a pupil, or do you pay, someone in the district office? Do you count that as a per pupil cost? So these are all debatable points, and that's why
I didn't realize those were up for debate. I would assume the entirety of the cost.
It is when you're building these rankings is my point.
So does anyone put the total cost and do the math per pupil, because that would be the per pupil cost, right?
Yes.
Because the whole district exists to educate the people.
Well, and it accounts for some of the difference in these rankings. It's another factor in addition to cost of living adjustments that we've been talking about here. But I think that when you look at the aggregate of these ratings, they tell you a story about California being behind the curve on school funding compared to the rest of the nation.
Susan Shelley, do you see it that way?
I think we need to talk about what the health benefits package is. You know, the district bargained away the ability for the school board to control the health benefits. They now have a committee which is headed by UTLA's representative. They tell the district what the benefits package is going to be, and the district just approves it. And what it is right now is for retirees and their dependents, for employees and their dependents, not just teachers, don't forget, but every employee who does anything at all.
This is common in the public sector.
Right. But every employee and all their dependents get free health insurance. They do not pay $1 toward that premium. The people who are paying this tax don't have that deal. the people who are going to be receiving a tax bill this year that is higher by $160 per 1,000 square feet of their home, they don't have this deal.
But the district wasn't able to negotiate for asking retirees to pick up some or all of the cost of their spouses for that insurance. They lost on that point.
Well, they lost on that point because where are their priorities? They have bargained away the ability to control costs in the district, and costs are out of control. And they have an enormous deficit. They told us before the teachers' strike that the demands of UTLA would bankrupt the district. And then they agreed to them. And then they came out smiling and said, we need a tax increase. It isn't fair. It isn't right. There are people who are in trouble in this state, in this city, who cannot pay their utility bills, who cannot pay their tax bills, who are moving to Arizona and Texas and Nevada. And this is the reason.
John in Long Beach says, I'm an employee of the Long Beach Unified School District. I always vote in favor of education bills, and I always see the money being mismanaged by administrators in the district. It never ends up going to help the students, so I've stopped voting for these measures. That's John in Long Beach. You can share your comment on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. Let's see. There's other comments here. Jeffrey writes on the page, I'm going to hold my nose and vote for EE because I believe in public education. But we live in the wealthiest state in the country. I'm tired of rich enclaves avoiding paying their fair share for educating all students, including lower-income urban and rural children. You can share your comments again on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Kyle, are you aware of any polling on this that gives a sense of the prospects for reaching the two-thirds threshold?
There is one poll out that I've seen from, I believe, that shows, depending on turnout, the yeses would outnumber the noes, but not quite enough to meet that threshold, the best-case scenario being something like 61% yes. The worst case scenario, if you're an EE supporter, 55% yes for EE. And so, again, you need two-thirds to pass these things. It's going to be a squeaker, I think, no matter what. There are still a fair number of undecided voters in those samples, though, so we'll see how they break.
And Jerry Newman at the LA Chamber of Commerce, my sense is that there was tremendous support for the teachers, at least among, you know, parents and those within the district's sphere of influence, so to speak. Your thoughts on whether that carries over here at the polling place?
Well, I think the district is counting on that. I think the district is leveraging the support that was received for the teachers during the strike into a ballot initiative in a special election that they didn't have to have. The reality is they are spending $12.5 million on a special election when voters just recently said we should be consolidating elections. They could have waited 8 months and had the election in March of next year and tried to raise the same amount of money and given people time to actually look at this and vet the issue and come up with a plan that everyone could have supported. The chamber merely asked for four things.
I'm sorry, I have to cut you off there. We're out of time, but my thanks to Jerry Newman, LA Area Chamber of Commerce, Susan Shelley, Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. Earlier in the hour, we heard from the superintendent of the LA Unified School District, Austin Buettner, and the president of United Teachers LA, representing teachers Alex Caputo-Pearl. They spoke, obviously, in favor of Measure EE, the parcel tax, on next Tuesday's ballot for those living within the boundaries of LA Unified. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up, the World Health Organization now defines burnout as its own syndrome, separate from other mental health conditions. We'll look at how the WHO defines burnout and what employers and employees can do to help alleviate work-related burnout. But first, one way to re-energize is visiting a local theme park. Southern California's ground zero for the live attraction wars. We've got Universal Studios Hollywood, Knott's Berry Farm, and Magic Mountain. But the market leader is, of course, Disneyland. Tomorrow, the park opens its largest expansion since it opened. Star Wars Galaxy's Edge takes up 14 acres in the park's northwest corner. Several frontier land attractions were removed for it, along with storage areas and administrative buildings. One of Disney's biggest challenges will be managing the massive numbers of people who want to see the new attraction in just its first few months. With us to talk about Star Wars Galaxy's Edge is Hugo Martin. He's Los Angeles Times reporter, covers travel, airlines, and theme parks as part of his beat. Hugo, good to have you with us again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So were you out there yesterday to preview the whole area?
Yeah, I was there for the press event.
So describe it for us. What's it look like as you walk in?
So it looks like you're on the set of a Star Wars movie. I mean, the detail is pretty incredible. It's a new land, but it looks like it's been there for hundreds of years because they want to make it look authentic. You know, real-size buildings, the Millennium Falcon is there, and several, you know, spaceships from all the Star Wars movies are there. They were inspired quite a bit by sort of Middle Eastern look. They wanted something that looked, you know, sort of unique and out of this world. So it's a combination of, you know, sci-fi and sort of Middle Eastern Turkish feel. But yeah, if you're a Star Wars fan, you're going to go nuts.
This is the biggest expansion in Disneyland's history. Now, can you compare the size of it to, say, California Adventure? How comparable in terms of the total acreage would this be?
Well, so this is a 14-acre expansion, and as you said earlier, they had to tear down some existing buildings and take out a few attractions. Yeah, their most recent expansion was Cars Land down at California Adventure, the neighboring park. That's a little bit smaller. It seems pretty expansive just because of the way it's built. It's, you know, the walkways are wider and the buildings are taller just to give it sort of a more expansive look, also to get, you know, foot traffic to move a little more smoothly through there.
How is Disney anticipating dealing with the customer demand? I've heard of 4-hour time limits, stuff like that. What's the plan for managing traffic?
Well, they've taken a pretty comprehensive look. I mean, as far as I can tell, and I've been covering this beat for about 10 years, this is the first time they've sort of taken a comprehensive look at dealing with crowding. And so there's a whole bunch of facets they looked at. One is easing foot traffic. And the way they've done that is to widen, you know, footpaths into the land. They've gotten rid of, you know, benches, and they've shrunk down some landscaping. Some trees had to be moved, some bushes, that sort of thing. Curbs. They've also banned wide strollers for children. They can't be over 51 inches wide. There was a smoking area. They got rid of that altogether because it was, you know, on the pathway into the land. They've banned wagons that, you know, families pull their kids around just to improve the flow. And as you've noted, for the first 3 weeks, you're going to have reservations to visit the land. And so that'll be handled, I think, with a wristband sort of system where if, say, you got a reservation for 8 o'clock Friday morning from 8 to noon, you have, say, a blue wristband, and you'll be allowed into the park during that hour, those 4 hours. And then when those 4 hours are up and it's time for people with the red wristbands, they start ushering you out and moving the next group in. It's really they're really sort of playing it by ear because they don't know, you know, how people will react. I mean, certainly there's going to be a huge demand for this land, and there's already a huge demand for Disneyland in general. So you add Star Wars Land, and they've got something that, you know, it's sort of double the demand, and they're going to have to figure out how to make it work.
Just to clarify, because I wasn't sure if the 4 hours is everybody that's in the Star Wars attraction comes in at the same time, leaves at the same time. That's a little easier to deal with moving people out. If it was going to be more staggered hour by hour, that might be hard because, you know, you'd have to then get into how do you escort people out, you know, if you got individuals who don't want to go?
Well, even with the four-hour window, you have to deal with people who are, say, I'm in line for the attraction and my 4 hours are up.
Do I
get out of line and miss it? Or, you know, I'm just ordering my food and now it's, my time is up. You know, Disney people say they're going to be lenient with those kind of situations. So it's yet to be seen if things get really hectic and there's a lot of crowding. We're going to have to see how stringent they're going to be about these four-hour limits.
We'll find out in a few minutes from Hugo what he thought of Millennium Falcon Smuggler's Run. He wrote that yesterday as part of the media preview of the Disneyland attraction Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, which opens to the public tomorrow. If you have questions for our guests about the new Disneyland attraction, we're at 866-893-KPECC. 866-893-5722. Also with us, the president of International Theme Park Services, which consults to the theme park industry, Dennis Spiegel. Thank you, Dennis, for being with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Appreciate your calling.
How does this fit into the theme park wars, particularly here in Southern California, where Universal in Hollywood has the Harry Potter attraction and Knott's is you know, trying to go back to its Berry Farm roots? How does this fit into that competition?
Well, there's no question we are in an armaments war. We're spending more money on capital in investment than we have in the history of the theme parks, which is about 65 years old. And there are two major areas, Southern California and Orlando, where the same parks compete. And what we're seeing is each is trying to outdo the other through technology. And we're at a point in our industry right now that we have technologies that weren't available 15, 20 years ago, and we can literally do things that just turn people upside down, both figuratively and
literally.
Right. And we can give them experiences that they've never seen before. And that's what Disney's doing. They set the bar for the industry. They always have since their inception in 1955. And the close second is Universal. They've done an amazing job of bringing us new entertainment forms, particularly the Harry Potter, as you pointed out. So the Star Wars Galaxy's Edge is that whole area is going to be a phenomena for our industry. And we trend the industry here at my company, and we watch everybody in the industry. And there's no question that this product is going to bring us growth.
Double digit. Dennis, 7 years ago was when Disney purchased Lucasfilm, and including the Star Wars properties. Does it take that long to do the planning and everything? You know, 7 years to from the acquisition of the company to open up an area of Disneyland?
Well, it does. There was a lot on the table at that point in time as they purchased the Lucas properties, all the Star Wars memorabilia, et cetera. And to get it right, get it planned perfectly, to introduce it in the manner that people expect. I mean, there are a lot of Star Wars fans around the world, and if you get it wrong 1%, they will tell you. So it does take that long anymore, particularly, Larry, with the technologies. The technologies from 7 years ago when that was announced, and we've been watching the development of it here at our company, the technologies have changed so much that things that they were anticipating using back then are not even being implemented now because there's so much greater technology available. So it does take time.
We're talking with Dennis Spiegel. He's president of International Theme Park Services. His firm consults with theme parks around the world and also consults on other leisure properties. Hugo Martin of the LA Times, reporter who covers airlines, hospitality, and theme parks. We have questions for our guests about the brand new Disneyland attraction, which opens to the public tomorrow, Star Wars Galaxy's Edge. We're at 866 813 KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dennis, I also wanted to ask you about the challenge that some of the parks have with these new attractions, like Harry Potter at Universal, like the Star Wars one at Disneyland. How do you keep from being a victim of one's own success? I would think that crowd management is really critical here, because if it gets overrun, if it becomes, so impacted that the word of mouth is going to be harmed, and you could ultimately end up, you know, damaging the attraction.
Well, you have to be very careful. And I have to tell you, Larry, that Disney, as Hugo pointed out, has done an amazing job of introducing this new timed system to allow people to come in and then usher them out when their time is up. And they've been very cognizant of this. We've been watching them work on this now for over a year internally to get it right. And they don't have all the answers yet. And you do have to be careful. I think probably the best example to give you and your listeners is the Harry Potter introduction in Orlando in 2010. Once the people were in the park, once they paid admission, come into Universal, they waited 8 hours to get into the Harry Potter area to experience the rides, the retail, the food, the butter beer, etc. So you have people that have such pent-up demand, have been waiting for this, they won't mind. That wait at Universal, incidentally, went on for 2 months.
That's incredible. How did they keep from having fist fights and riots with an eight-hour wait?
Well, they managed it well. As you know, we're a hospitable industry.
Ply them with drinks. I mean, that's...
Well, they did. I'm not sure about the alcohol content.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a lot of butter beer given out, I remember. I was down there for that opening. And the other thing that's, I think, just incredible, when Harry Potter opened in 2010, attendance went up 36%. We had never seen that kind of growth in a one-year attendance pattern ever in our industry. And that's why I said at the end, I believe we're going to see some large double-digit growth at Disney.
Well, it explains why at Universal Studios they tore down that amphitheater and put in the Harry Potter attraction, because that's sort of is a no-brainer. Dennis Spiegel with us, International Theme Park Services. Hugo Martin, L.A. Times. So you rode Millennium Falcon Smuggler's Run. What'd you think of the ride?
It's basically the biggest and most expensive video game you'll ever play. It's a simulator ride, which means you're in a seat or a room that, you know, gyrates up and down sideways, and there's a surround screen in front of you that, you know, it's coordinated with the movement, so it feels like you're flying and you're dipping and you're, you know, jumping over things. So it's an amazing technology. It's not completely new. You'll see other rides like the Simpsons rides at Universal and some of the others that use the same basic technology, but this one is a bit more advanced in that the riders get to control the vehicle in a way. I mean, there are six seats in the what looks like the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon, two pilots, two engineers, and two gunners, and you're set out on a mission to collect this mineral that they need for there's a backstory. You need this mineral, and so you're on a mission to go get it. The two people on the front are the pilots. You're flying around trying to catch up to this spaceship that has the minerals. The gunners have to shoot at the bad guys that are coming and trying to prevent you from doing this. And then the engineers have to shoot out these cables to try to, you know, attach to this shipment of minerals. And the funny thing about it is it's a video game in that the more of these crystals you acquire, the higher your point score is on the screen. But then they deduct the damage that you cause the Millennium Falcon. and you've got a score. The thing that I'm interested in is, you know, people are going to get on this and go, oh, I only scored 200. I'm going to get back on and do better next time. Next thing you know, you're in the line right after you've just gotten out because you want to up your score. I think that's going to be a challenge for Disney because, you know, so many people are going to want to ride this that you might have to limit people. You might have to say, okay, one ride per visit or mm-hmm. something to that effect, or one ride every 4 hours.
Hugo Martin, do you sometimes have to pinch yourself? You get paid to go to theme parks and take the rides like this.
Yeah. No, I've been to them all, and
not a bad gig.
They're a lot of fun, and it's amazing how advanced they've become.
Hugo, before I let you go, just anything else to add that you thought was particularly notable, worked well, or maybe raised some questions for you about the new Star Wars area?
Well, the funny thing is they want you to feel like you're on an alien planet, down to the employees working there will speak to you as if, hey, Earthling, how are you? You know, oh, here we have beer. This is something that you and your planet people like to drink. The signs on the buildings are not in English. They're in this alien Arabish language, so you have to ask people, you know, what is in that building, or you have to. There's also an app that they're supposed to give you for your smartphone that you could read it. The food is also, you know, not typical. You could order short ribs, and they won't taste like short ribs you get here. And they've got some funky flavors, and they've tried some, you know, combination of sweet and sour to make you feel like you're in another planet. This is not American food. This is not an American, you know, destination. It's another planet.
All right, Hugo, thanks so much. I'm sure it's going to be just a huge attraction for months to come. We're talking about Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, the new attraction at Disneyland, which opens to the public tomorrow. And our thanks to Dennis Spiegel of International Theme Park Services. Coming up on Air Talk, the World Health Organization has made it official. Burnout is an actual syndrome separate and apart from any other mental health challenge. We'll talk about what it is, what causes it, and more in just 1 minute. Tomorrow I have two very important programming notes for you. Film Week, which typically airs at 11 o'clock tomorrow, will not air until noon. We are delaying Film Week by an hour tomorrow. That's so we can bring you an hour-long statewide call-in program, Election 2020 Kickoff. I'll be hosting the statewide program from Los Angeles, but we'll be linking up with stations in the San Francisco Bay Area, Sacramento, San Diego, the Central Valley, and elsewhere throughout the Golden State. In the 11 o'clock hour, we'll be taking calls and finding out from your fellow California Public Radio listeners what they would like to see in a presidential nominee. California has an outsized role in choosing the Democratic nominee with our primary early next year. This will give a chance to get a sense of what public radio listeners want to see in that candidate. Again, that's tomorrow, 11 o'clock, our second hour right here on KPCC devoted to Election 2020 Kickoff. And then Film Week will be delayed until the noon hour tomorrow right here on 89.3. Well, burnout is a term that we often hear people use, but the question is, what really is it? And is it a real thing? I've always thought of burnout as sort of an amalgam of other issues, including stress and boredom and resentment about having to do a particular job. But according to the World Health Organization, it's its own thing. Joining us to talk about burnout is professor at RWTH Aachen University in Germany, a co-author of an influential review of studies on burnout, Torsten Voigt. Thank you very much, Professor Voigt, for being with us.
Thank you, Larry. I'm really excited to talk about this important topic today.
So define burnout. What is it?
That's a very good question. It's a really challenging question because for a long time it was not very clear what burnout is, and even now it's not very precisely defined. But generally speaking, burnout is a state or a mental health challenge that's related to the workplace, and it's mostly defined by feelings of exhaustion, fatigue, frequent headaches, sleeplessness, and other physical symptoms. And then there are kind of some behavioral signs like frustration, anger, suspicion, excessive use of tranquilizers, sometimes also overconfidence or omnipotence, and then sometimes signs of depression. So basically, the way you describe it is kind of this interesting amalgam of different different mental health challenges.
Now, when I think of burnout, I think there has to be a burn before it can be burned out, right? So does this imply that at some point in time, the individual had enthusiasm for work, was fulfilled by it, but that there reached a point where those positive qualities fell by the wayside? Or could someone start a job that's just a terrible fit for him or her, and they're burned out from the beginning?
No, I think you're absolutely right. This idea is that there's this saying, you have to burn in order to burn out. And so it is this idea that burnout would not affect anyone, but that there is a specific personality type that is the dedicated and the committed who are more prone to burnout, at least. And that if you are basically disconnected from your work from the very beginning, the likelihood of getting burnout, at least according to most of the studies, is not as high.
We're talking with Mann, who's the lead author on a meta-study of burnout. His published back in 2017, a professor at RWTH Aachen University in Germany, Torsten Voigt. If you have questions about burnout, the nature of it, and how we quantify it or understand it, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You know, one of the things I think about burnout is that certain of us have the luxury of feeling burned out, but for other people, you just work through it. There's not even a chance to acknowledge being burned out because you just have to suck it up. You got to go to work every day and find whatever you can to get through it. So how do you differentiate between people who sort of don't have the luxury of experiencing burnout versus those that do?
Oh, that's a very good question. And you're absolutely right that there is this dimension of socioeconomic status that makes the whole idea of burnout more challenging, and that you indeed already have to have this identification with the job, that you have to be really interested and dedicated. And if you have to work for a living and to barely get by, then you may not even have the opportunity to like your job. You just have to do it. And so in a way, it is indeed a phenomenon that is related to very specific tasks, also those where you are emotionally involved in a way. And if you are already emotionally disconnected from the very beginning, there is not so much an issue with burnout. And it may be other mental health challenges that are more at play.
Do we understand why certain jobs that fit the description you just gave, that have that sort of high emotional investment component, where the perception is the stakes may be high, or at least the employee enthusiasm for the mission of the job is high, and reach burnout, versus those that don't seem to hit that wall, hit that point? Do we understand enough about the phenomenon to know why some people get it, or why certain types of jobs that fit what you described might and others not?
Well, there are some indicators, but the challenge really is that for basically 40 years, the state of burnout has been contested, and there has been a lot of controversy in the scientific community, specifically among psychiatrists and clinical psychologists, as to who is prone to burnout and also what the causes of burnout are. And this is also why the WHO does not define it as a distinct disease, but just says it's a syndrome, which means, or it's not a disorder, it's a syndrome, which means that there is a set of symptoms that we can identify, but that the cause is at least not fully understood. Even though there are some causes that we can identify, and on the one hand, I already described some of the personality aspects of it, that you really have to be in a situation where you're highly committed to your job and where you also are in a situation where you were really willing to deliver and, as you put it, be on fire for what you do. And then secondly, there are some organizational factors that are relevant. And it's mostly work environments that require a lot of emotional work and empathy, then a lot of personal involvement and also intrinsic motivation. And that definitely contributes to people experiencing burnout.
I also wonder about mutual support. When you've got, and I'm not saying, you know, that public safety personnel like firefighters and police officers can't get burned out. Obviously, they can. But when you're part of a team and you have kind of a collegial social component that goes along with the work, I wonder if that is a possible buffer helping people, because you have other people that you're close to in the working environment experiencing the same sort of mission-driven, emotionally charged work as yourself. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So there are studies that exactly show that if that burnout occurs more often if you have individualized tasks. And the moment you work in a team, and then also, as you put it, like you have this kind of buffer, you can support each other. And then also on a larger scale, if the organization provides support for their employees, it is possible at least to prevent burnout to a certain degree, or at least reduce the prevalence of burnout significantly. And so it's very important to acknowledge that burnout is not just a personal problem, but that it is a organizational one and also a societal one that we have to address on the different levels, and that it's not something we should leave up to the individual to deal with.
We're talking with Professor Thorsten Voigt of RWTH Aachen University in Germany, who co-authored an influential meta-study looking at burnout as a phenomenon. He published his meta-study back in 2017. Professor Voigt, thank you for being with us today. Fascinating to talk about this, which now the World Health Organization has recognized as its own distinct syndrome. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we talk with the CEO of the LA Philharmonic, Simon Wood, joining us. Simon came to Los Angeles just over a year ago to lead the LA Phil, followed in the footsteps of Deborah Borda. Simon Woods will tell us about the challenges and plans for this centennial year of the LA Phil. That's coming up very, very shortly. Just a reminder, tomorrow, Film Week coming up at noon instead of 11. Our statewide election 2020 call-in comes your way at 11 o'clock tomorrow. Now time for an update from Hetty. Just over 25 years ago, the well-regarded Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra started on the path to becoming arguably the most important orchestra in the country. Esa-Pekka Salonen brought his youthful inventiveness and compositional skills. He handed the baton to an even younger maestro, Gustavo Dudamel. Dudamel and former CEO Deborah Borda led the LA Phil to its greatest acclaim and influence, artistically and culturally. Now, as the organization prepares to celebrate its centennial, Dudamel's professional partner is CEO Simon Woods. He's been at the helm over a year after leading the Seattle Symphony, and he joins us this morning on Air Talk. Simon, thank you for being with us.
Thanks. Good morning, Larry. Great to be here. Thanks.
I appreciate it. So, this had to be, in a sense, both a dream job because of the LA Phil's prestige and the esteem in which it's held, but following Deborah Borda is not an easy thing to do, a formidable presence.
Sure, Deborah. I mean, look, Deborah's a legend, right? But Deborah, I've been friends with Deborah for a number of years. She was very supportive of me, and I know a lot about what she did here, and I'm a huge admirer. So for me, one of the great things about coming here was being able to pick up that mantle, pick up all the great work she's done and think about, you know, what happens next? How do we look after that legacy and take it into the future? So it's an honor to follow her, and it's an honor to be part of this organization, which is it's just a dynamic, remarkable, extraordinary group of people.
Borda now back at the New York Philharmonic, yes, leading that, which is where she came from to Los Angeles. So you come from Seattle, also a dynamic orchestra. You'd made a major hire there artistically, and by all accounts, you loved living up there, a beautiful part of the country. So what is it you felt like you could bring from the Northwest to Los Angeles maybe hadn't been done here?
Well, look, I mean, first of all, from my own point of view, you know, I grew up in London, so I grew up in a global city. And so for me, the attraction of being you know, Seattle's an amazing city, but Los Angeles is a global city, right? This is a city that is on the world stage. It's a city that's right in the forefront of arts and culture today. It's a city going through an incredible artistic renaissance. So for me, coming here and being part of that community here in LA was something very special and very precious. Look, Seattle is a very different city to LA, but it's also a West Coast city. So there was a familiarity to me and, you know, in transitioning from one city to another. You know, I think they're both cities with dynamic intellectual lives, very open-minded audiences. So there's a lot that felt very familiar about it. But clearly, LA is a vast stage to which the vast canvas on which to paint, and that's the exciting thing for me.
Well, in Seattle, a city that doesn't have much link to Europe, or you wouldn't think naturally to European music. So, in some way, the orchestra has to think: how do you connect culturally with a city that's different? Here in Los Angeles, an international city, that of course an even bigger challenge. How do you take what the core repertoire of which is European and bring people in who have no link to the culture at all?
Well, a couple of things about that. First of all, I think Seattle and Los Angeles share in common one thing. As I look at both organizations, both orchestras in both cities, in Seattle we worked really hard to make sure that the Seattle Symphony was the symphony not only in the city but of the city. And I feel very strongly in the same way about the LA Phil. You know, we're an orchestra that is here to both reflect, to amplify, and be here for the people of our community. And so that sense of place, that sense of creating a sense of place and pride for a major arts organization is very important to me. But I think there's a lot we can do, and we've already started to do it through the Centennial, to think about how we broaden the audience we appeal to. And the LA Phil has a long history of being in the community, of speaking to broader audiences than merely the small group of people who might be called classical music aficionados. So I think we've got a long history of thinking bigger.
Well, in having a Venezuelan conductor, having a Latino at the helm as music director of the organization, who plays music from well beyond Europe, from the Americas, from Asia, all of that provides connections for people from different communities.
It totally does, but it's not only about the nationality of the music you're playing. It's about the spirit with which you play it. And I think that what Gustavo Dudamel has said time and time again is, you know, he has this fundamental belief that music is a fundamental human right. And he said that many times. And it comes from deep within him, this idea that music is there for everybody and should be there for everybody. And so I think playing a broad range of music, playing it in broad settings like the Hollywood Bowl, being in communities, being, you know, on the radio, being touring abroad, these are all part of a much bigger vision about being there for the widest possible
free
audience.
Concerts with the Ciclovia bike
exactly.
Event.
And what a day that was.
Yeah. Quite the marathon.
Quite extraordinary day.
We're talking with Simon Woods, the CEO of the LA Philharmonic, on the job just close to a year and a half, joining us on Air Talk to look at the future of the organization in its centennial year and how an arts organization like this continues to evolve to connect with such a multifaceted community as Southern California. You have a tremendous advantage here that I don't know that any other symphony has across the country, and that is the Hollywood Bowl,
sure.
Arguably the number one outdoor venue in the country.
Yeah.
Not only is it rich in culture and history, it's big, 17,000 some seats.
Yeah.
So you make a lot of money off of that venue. How much of a cushion does that give you to experiment, to do other things?
Well, the thing about the Hollywood Bowl is, as you say, it's enormous. It's an enormous venue, and we do run it. It's leased from the County of Los Angeles, but we have all the responsibilities for the cost for running it. So, as well as having enormous audiences, it also has enormous costs in it. If you think, come to the Hollywood Bowl and you see the sheer scale of the operation. You know, the parking, the security, the catering, you know, we run all of that. So it is undoubtedly advantageous to us. But I think the main way in which it's advantageous to us and how it allows us to speak to a broader audience. Because if you go to the Hollywood Bowl on a night when Gustavo's conducting and you see, you know, 17,000 people sitting out there with their picnics and their families, with the, you know, with the crickets going in the background and listening to Beethoven. I mean, every arts manager, arts professional's nirvana, being able to be in a place where it is accessible to so many people. So I think that's the way I look at it. It's an extraordinary asset to this city and to the people of this city.
But when you couple the sponsorship opportunities with the bowl, which are, I mean, so much of that is named sponsorships and just the opportunity to sell tickets, not just the classical, but all the other, the jazz, the popular music, all those other events. That's just got to give you a peace of mind that other CEOs of orchestras don't have.
Yeah, it does certainly provide us with a very solid revenue stream. But the way we think about it is about how we invest our resources in the community. And one of the things that's been extraordinary about the LA Phil over the years is the way in which it's really invested in giving back to the community in so many ways. The YOLA program being the most obvious example. And
Youth Orchestra LA.
Yeah, Youth Orchestra LA, where we're just about to build building a brand new youth home for YOLA in Inglewood, designed by Frank Gehry. So, you know, we're constantly reinvesting. And what the Hollywood Bowl does, it gives us that stability, financial stability, to be able to invest in the community and invest in the art.
What about in commissioning works from young and diverse composers? What do you see as the role of the orchestra in doing that?
Well, we see the music of our time as fundamentally as important as the music of the past. And I think that's a fundamental difference of perspective that you find at the LA Phil that is different to most orchestras. We really don't see the music of our time as something we add on to our program. We see it as something at the core. And, you know, we're just about in a week or so's time to have our big major celebration called Noon to Midnight, where we have 12 hours of contemporary music programming right through the building. That's about as big a commitment to the music of our time as you could imagine.
We're talking with Simon Woods, the CEO of the LA Phil. We're talking about Centennial Year, the programming that's to come, as well as the community mission of the LA Philharmonic. You're listening to Gustavo Dudamel conducting the LA Phil. We'll be back with more in just 1 minute here on Air Talk. Part of the LA Phil's appeal isn't just that they play the classical canon, but play popular music as well. The LA Philharmonic, under the direction of Gustavo Dudamel, with Star Wars theme Throne Room. John Williams, the composer, of course. Williams with a close relationship with the LA Phil for many, many years. We're talking right now with the CEO of the LA Phil, Simon Woods, who has been heading the orchestra for just over a year. He arrived from the Seattle Symphony. He was born, schooled in London, in Britain, and then comes to the United States, where he's had his professional arts career. We're talking about the future of the LA Phil, as well as the challenges to arts organizations in funding and outreach as well. well. Let's talk a little bit about what you've got coming up this year, because I mentioned this is the centennial year, and you've got the birthday celebration gala and concert coming up this fall, October 24th, Walt Disney Concert Hall, and you are bringing back Zubin Mehta, Esa-Pekka Salonen, Dudamel, all together, the triple play, so to speak.
Absolutely.
All in one place.
It's going to be amazing. That date, of course, is the actual date of the LA Phil's first concert back in 1919. And so we had this idea that we would try to bring all the three living music directors on the stage at one time. And not only are they each going to conduct something separately, but there's a new piece being written by Daniel Bjarnason for three conductors, orchestra and three conductors. I don't think anybody knows yet exactly what that means, but we're going to find out. But it'll be a remarkable evening to have everybody on the stage together.
That sounds, even if it's a stunt, that sounds fun.
I think it'll be more than a stunt. I think there'll be some real music there.
Yeah, that sounds, well, another example of new works that the orchestra will be performing. Growing up here in Los Angeles, I have fond memories of Zubin Mehta because he really is the flamboyant conductor that kind of, you know, got the LA Phil attention. They even did music videos that you'd see on television. You know, that really helped to raise the profile just because his personality.
It did. But actually, there's something else which is important about Zubin Mehta, which is, you know, he came with a very Central European training. So he came, you know, he studied in Vienna. And what he did here was work so hard to cultivate a beautiful sound and a beautiful kind of European sensibility to the orchestra, really bring that kind of Viennese style. So there's a very important part of our history is goes back to Zubin's time. And it's interesting, you know, the people who came after him, everybody bought something different.
Yeah, Andre Previn.
Andre Previn, of course, who passed away recently, very sadly. You know, and then, of course, Esa-Pekka Salonen and Gustavo Dudamel. Each one has put their stamp on the orchestra in a different way. One of the things that's been really fun for me during this year has been going back and listening to some of the recordings through the different eras. And, you know, it's every recording shows what a great orchestra it is. But each music director brought something special.
It's interesting. And we memorialized Andre Previn with a segment here on Air Talk when he died. And he, of course, famously didn't set foot in Los Angeles after his difficult parting with Ernest Fleischman, who was your predecessor many years ago when you were a lad. And I wonder if Previn had physically been able to travel and was living, would you have tried to do everything you could to convince him to come be there for the centennial?
Well, in fact, actually, the contribution that he was going to make was to write us a new piece. He was writing us a new work, which we were going to premiere during the centennial. And when he passed away, so suddenly, we were on tenterhooks for, you know, for a week or so, waiting to find out, did he write the piece? Sadly, he didn't. So we don't have the piece, which is a great shame because that would have been a beautiful memory to have as part of the centennial.
But it shows that at least a bit of the rancor had subsided.
Oh, totally.
The years.
He was absolutely committed, and he was looking forward to hearing it. So it's very sad.
Simon Wood, CEO of the LA Phil, joining us on Air Talk. What are your principal initiatives for the orchestra over the next few years?
Well, we're thinking very hard, of course, about how we continue to build and expand YOLA, Youth Orchestra LA. I mean, our presence in Inglewood, building this new building with which Frank Gehry is designing for us, is as important. I think people in Inglewood, you know, the Mayor Butts in Inglewood, and others in Inglewood will tell you this is as important as an initiative for Inglewood as the stadium. It is in a different way. And so we're proud to be part of the revitalization of that part of Los Angeles. So that's a big journey for us. We're starting construction now. The first cohort of young people will come in the fall of next year. So that's huge.
Well, can you imagine somewhere down the road when the first YOLA graduate ends up playing in the LA Phil?
Well, it won't be so long in the future, because if you think about it, the program's about 10 years old now. So we're now starting to see the kids who started going to music college, and it will be within the next few years that they're now starting. They're starting to get professional jobs.
Of course, very high bar to get the LA Phil.
It's a high bar, but you know, this is the point. This is one of the points of the program, to try and create a pathway for musicians of color, particularly, to progress into the profession, which is for a very long time been something very difficult. So we're really trying to change the paradigm around that.
What do the surveys that you and other classical music organizations conduct, what does it show about the ability to cultivate more diverse audiences for classical music? Is there, I mean, obviously young musicians is a way to go. Jazz has pursued that with young musicians and college jazz programs. What do you see as the ability to cultivate the broader audience for classical?
Well, I think it's being very contemporary minded. You know, it's being perceived not to be a museum of the past, but to be a living, thriving institution that reflects what's going on in the world. You know, we love to think very hard about what are the big events going on in the world that we can, we can take into our programming. We've got a whole series happening next season called Power to the People, which is about music of protest, which is, a sort of foray into an interesting area of the arts. And there will be many other things like that coming in the future. So it's not just about the music in abstract. It's about how do we use music to kind of convene important, meaningful discussions in our society and our community as well.
Simon Wood, CEO of the LA Philharmonic, joining us on Air Talk today. What do you see as the kind of suitable cross-genre collaborations that the LA Phil can engage in? And are there certain things that you think are inappropriate for the LA Phil to, say, work with pop artists? Or where would you draw that line where it makes sense?
I don't know that I really do draw a line, to be honest. I think one of the things that's distinguished the LA Phil is that they've always said anything is possible. We want to do opera on the stage of Walt Disney Concert Hall? Fine, we'll build a stage. We want to do dance? Fine, we'll do dance. We've got many major dance collaborations we've done. Of course, we collaborate all the time with pop artists and artists from different genres. Natalie Lafourcade, who's with Gustavo this year at the Hollywood Bowl, that'll be one of the big events of the summer. So I don't really think there are any limits, as long as you are always, as you're bringing art forms together, you're always respecting both art forms and doing them both at the very highest possible level.
And it's always a challenge for the orchestra to be able to do what it does best in those collaborations. Doesn't have to take a back seat necessarily to the popular artists, and that's always the challenge with those.
Right, but every collaboration is different, and you always find a way to make the orchestra shine somehow. It's the greatest orchestra in the world, why wouldn't we?
Simon, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Simon Wood, CEO of the LA Philharmonic. From all of us at Air Talk, have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next.